My name is Willie Scott, and this is the second part of hopefully a two-part series on racism in the criminal justice system. The focus today, hopefully, by my design, is that we take a look at what we can do as Christian people, as church people. So I want to say welcome to those of you who came today. How many are here from yesterday? Okay, so all of you, for the most part, barring one, are new. Let me just give you a little background of what I did yesterday. Certainly, I don't want to go back and regurgitate that, but I do want to give you a flavor of the kind of material I covered yesterday or attempted to. Took a look at, first of all, a kind of definition of racism, so that we would all be pretty much on the same footing. And basically, my definition is that racism represents power through the use of institutions of a race against another. Often it is one particular race, but other races and cultures may join in by way of their identification, by way of their support, in the way that the activities of the institution serve to bring oppression upon a particular class or race of people. That's a kind of working definition. I make a distinction between racism and racist attitude, because I think anybody can have a racist attitude, but that doesn't mean that you are necessarily going to impact in a negative way on someone. I think all of us are racist in attitudes to some extent by virtue of the fact we tend to prefer our own. We do that psychologically out of the need for security. We do it because we trust those that we know. So that much is expected, but racism, when it becomes a practice of oppression, is quite different, and that's when we need to begin to become much more aware of our behavior, our activities. Let me just tell you a little bit about myself and where I'm coming from. I'm a psychologist by training, and I am working within the criminal justice system. I have been a psychologist for 16 years in the Recorder's Court psychiatric clinic, and began there as a staff psychologist, and now have been and am serving as director, having been so for the last 6 years. I've seen a lot in the years that I've been there, and I got to tell you, it's not a very pleasant job, but you have to put things in perspective. It's not pleasant because we have the dubious distinction of, first of all, servicing perhaps one of the most, in fact it is, one of the most busy criminal courts in the country. Certainly it is the most busy criminal court in the state of Michigan, seeing some or processing some 12, 13, 14,000 criminal cases per year. The clinic that I direct sees approximately 20% of the total caseload, and we evaluate all for the purpose of providing opinions on most of the court-related issues, and I'm quite sure some of you have at least some awareness of what that's all about. You've heard of, if nothing else, you've heard of insanity issues, questions of whether or not one was sane at the time he or she committed an offense. Well, we do those kinds of things, but we do other things like bond consideration. Judges often like to know who should be placed on bond, whether or not there are issues of dangerousness, issues of competency, you know, whether or not persons are able to stand trial. We see defendants before trial, which would be a bond issue, and we also see them bond issues before trial, competency before trial, and even criminal responsibility, which is the sanity thing before trial. But a large bulk of the work is for pre-sentence reports. Practically speaking, what that means is that after a person has been found guilty by a judge or a jury, or after one has pled guilty, the judge then is cast in the position of trying to figure out what's the best thing to do with this person. And so these defendants, or convicts at that point, are sent to us oftentimes for an opinion regarding their strengths, their weaknesses, their motivation. For example, if it's a person who is mentally ill, we need to address whether or not that person is interested in treatment, whether or not he or she would benefit from that kind of service if it were made available to them. So that's the kind of work. It's tough, but it's not. It has redeemed my sense of humanity to some extent, because as I shared yesterday, I always thought that criminals were the worst lot of the community. Well, I've come to find out that they are not terribly different from many other Americans. The difference is that of the kind of, you know, they represent blue-collar crime. And as all of you probably know, blue-collar crime is not the only crime that is committed in America. For some reason or another, we have picked on the blue-collar crimes and have made them the bad guys, you know, who need to be dealt with. And I agree, they need to be dealt with, but they are not the only element of criminal activity in the community that we need to be bothered with. We need to be very concerned about organized crime. As one lady aptly pointed out yesterday, who is responsible, you know, at the very base of bringing drugs into the community? Who are the drug lords, you know, the real drug lords, not the cheap guys running around, not even the ones who have a lot of gold, the ones driving, you know, expensive vehicles? Those are not the real animals. Much more fundamentally, the ones who are providing the airplanes, the ones who are cooking up the deals, the ones who are using political persuasion to get things done, those are people who are just as, I won't say they're less important, you know, I won't say they're more important, you know, but they're just as important as the, but we don't focus on them and we don't view them as the real bad guys. In fact, they don't really have an identity, if you think about it. So they're in a kind of racism within the criminal justice system, just in the way that we view who is the truly bad guy, you know. Now, we may passively say that the white-collar criminals are bad guys, but we don't have a view of them, do we? We don't, you know, we don't see people in ties and white shirts and pinstriped suits, and indeed those people dress like that. We don't view them as criminals, and so we don't view them as having the kind of impact on life that they really do. But anyway, that's the kind of background information that I attempted to give yesterday, along with stats. Pointed out that when we talk about the criminal justice system, I meant the police, the courts, and the departments of corrections. The police target people for arrest. The courts sentence people. There are disparities, racial disparities in sentencing. I covered some of that yesterday, and the same thing applies for the departments of corrections. Vast, disproportionate numbers of people of color who are locked up. I gave you some top 10 nationally, states that lock up people according to race, and I did the same thing for the southern states, and pointed out, contrary to popular belief, When it comes to racial patterns, the southern states are not as abusive toward people of color as we would like to think sometimes. It turns out that the Midwestern, the Sun Belt, in fact not just Midwest, but the Western, the Sun Belt states, Arizona being at the top, Idaho is one of them, and some others. And of course, the way we look at that is how many persons per 100,000 are locked up. Arizona has approximately 1,200 blacks per 100,000 detained versus 150 whites per 100,000. Did I say blacks, people of color, 1,200 people of color versus, okay. And so that's the way we look at that, and there are vast problems with that. I also pointed out that while racism is a bad word, it's something that we have to live with, and we have to also view our racist behavior in terms of passive and active. And it's not racist behavior is not just limited to whites, as we like to think. You know, black folks would like to think it's only white folks who support the institutions. It's not true. Because most people have nothing to do with the active racism that is practiced in this country. Most people go about their business and simply become preoccupied with daily living. And they don't have time to be thinking about how the institutions are oppressing anybody. That goes for me, that goes for most of us in here, unless you happen to be an unusual, person. So there is active and there is passive acts of racism. I think all of us, by and large, support our major institutions by virtue of the fact we're not launching any activities to turn things around. And so institutions don't run on their own. We like to think, in fact, we rationalize sometimes and say, the institution has a life of its own. That's just a way of saying we don't want to take responsibility for the dirt that's being done. They do not have a, they're run according to the dictates of man. We are behind what happens, whether we like it or not. If we ask the question, who is to blame, I think we have to say all of us are to blame. And the part that I'd like to talk about today, and quite honestly, I want much of this to be discussion, because that's helpful for me. I didn't come just to tell you. I don't have that much wisdom. I'm simply sharing information with you, and I'm hoping that you came to share your thoughts and ideas as well. So it's a privilege for me to be here, but it's not a privilege for me to come in and take the posture that I'm telling you what's right for America and what's right for the community. I'm looking for answers, to be honest. I think that in answering or attempting to answer the question of what are we to do, I think we first of all need to see the church and ourselves as instruments of change. Now that sounds like a cliche, but we have to really look at that very carefully, and I think when we do, we'll see that they're possibilities, but they're very time-consuming, and they're not things that happen overnight. So we need to take an attitude that we can indeed make a difference. We need to take a much more holistic view of ourselves in relation to the problems that confront us with respect to the criminal justice system. Indeed, we need to pray. I think that that is frequently done. I won't say that that's done enough, but the point I want to make is that prayer is one thing. We can go to church every Sunday, and indeed we can find a place of solitude at home, and we can offer prayer. Never enough of that, but there are other things that we need we need to do, and that is, I think we need to be active persons. We need to be people who see ourselves involved in activity. We need to say that we are linked with institutions, that we are sharing ourselves, sharing resources, sharing, you know, that old cliche, time, talent, and what's the other one? Resources, isn't it? We need to do those kinds of things. We really need to do some serious, very serious feeling. We need to feel the pulse of each other. We need to do much more of what we're doing here at Holden Village for this period of Rainbow at the Mountaintop. We need to get to know each other. We need to begin to appreciate the humanity of each other. We need to break down barriers, and that's why we need to do this kind of thing. We need to pull away from many of the fears that we have. Unwarranted fears. It's no question about it, as I indicated yesterday when I first started to work in the criminal justice system. I really had a fear of criminals, and notwithstanding the fact that they're black, that doesn't make any difference at all. Black people in the community are terrified of criminals, and they carry many of their stereotypes just like European Americans do. They're not exempt from that by any stretch of the imagination. So one of the things I've come to appreciate is that criminal people are, first of all, people. They bleed, they feel, they have aspirations, they want a better life, they want the same things that that we want. Can't make any assumption about their being on the other side of the tracks and don't care about the right side of life. I think all of us, by and large, excluding the severe pathological types, you know, who, and I'm not even sure about that group, by the way. The question was asked whether or not I thought Bundy, what's Bundy's first name?
Ted Bundy.
Ted Bundy. Whether or not I thought Ted Bundy, you know, really didn't want to be integrated into human life, you know, to be loving and to give love. And as a psychologist, I don't think that's true. I think that if that was where he was in his life status, he got there by way of hurt. He got there by way of abuse, some damage, because by and large, if we subscribe to the basic theory of humanity, most of us, all of us, I would go so far as to say, want love. You know, some of you probably have heard of Maslow's theory of human needs. That is, you know, we have a need for shelter, and one of those needs, out of the hierarchy of needs that he addresses, is that we have a need for affiliation. We have a need for each other. We have a need, basically, for love. And so what happens frequently is that we, through some mishap, we get on the wrong tracks and fail to meet those needs in appropriate ways. Now, we don't like to believe that. We just like to think that, you know, you're a rotten so-and-so, and you know, you've been that way all your life, and we don't want to have anything to do with you. Get out of my life. I don't want to be bothered with you. I think that, you know, as Christian people, that's an attitude that we can't afford to maintain. So those who are in the criminal justice system are really crying out for us. And we have to find a way to meet them. We need to feel their humanity. In addition and to that, and beyond that, we need to put things on an intellectual level. We need to become much more sensible about what to do with people who are coming into the criminal justice system. If you put your feelings aside, just ask yourself, what are we to do with the tremendous numbers that I shared yesterday? And again, I don't need to go back to those, but suffice it to say, the numbers are enormous. One little piece I can share with you is that in Michigan, we have doubled the number of people who are incarcerated in the last 8 years. We've gone from 14,000 to 30,000. Now, we have the tendency to insulate ourselves, you know, from those figures, because that way we don't have to struggle, but we can't afford to do that, because those numbers, the 14,000, not to focus on the tragedy of their being incarcerated, but strictly from a budgetary sense, those numbers represent a phenomenal amount of money. I've never added it up, but I think, as I shared yesterday, we had in Michigan to build new institutions to house them. And so the new institutions themselves cost $50,000 to $80,000 per person, per bed, you know, to lock up. And as Ingrid said yesterday, that's one figure, but the other figure is how much it costs to keep them housed per year. And costs the same thing as it costs to put a kid through an Ivy League university. Maybe more. Now that to me is astounding, you know. So even if you're not a good Christian, you know, I mean, just look at that particular figure, and it's a threat to our survival. In the state of Michigan, we have a tremendous budget problem. We've been sailing along quite well for the last 5 or 6 years. All of a sudden, we have, you know, because of the crackdown on crack, we have these numbers of people incarcerated just growing with leaps and bounds, you know. And finally, in 1989, well, a couple of things are happening. You know, the economy is not the same. The purchase of automobiles is sagging, and so we're hurting that way. We're getting it from two angles, though. The other side is that the numbers of people who, you know, plus we have to gear up the police departments. I'd forgotten about that, you know, to deal with all these people. So that figure alone is enough to move us to the point of trying to figure out what to do. We can't lock people up, you know, fast enough. And we'll never be able to lock them up fast enough, I don't believe. Not only that, now, even if you wanted to lock them up and rehabilitate them, you don't hear that word much anymore. You notice that? Rehabilitation has taken a backseat, a real fallacy. But it's done defensively, because nobody wants to talk rehabilitation. The cost of rehabilitation would I would imagine, close to double the budget if you did it very sensibly. So we've actually settled in to just locking people away. The tragedy of that is that once you lock them in, they come back to the community worse off the second time or the third time around, less able to fit in the community, because then they carry the stigma. And of course, if they've been locked up for that period of time, they have done nothing with their time, except frequently become much more angry, certainly much more alienated, much more ingrained into their system is a value structure that is removed from, you know, major society. These are people, mind you, who have already gone in with less than what it takes to be productive. You know, that's a highfalutin, you know, term, to become productive members of society. These people have not thought of themselves as productive members of society. But that's what we need them to do. Unfortunately, also, even if they came out with some kinds of skills, we don't have the jobs available to put them to work. And so we have this tremendous, you know, I can't convey to you the importance, you know, that all of this has on the potential for adjustment of these people who are in need. We need to change our attitude. We need to start looking at, you know, what we can do in terms of feeling who these people are, and then simply intellectually saying something has to be done, and then begin to look for ways. What we are talking about, what I'm particularly concerned about, is how we can involve ourselves as a church. There are many ways that you can make your presence felt politically, through individual efforts and what have you, but let's talk about the church, and this is where I want you to do some thinking as well. I think that one of the problems we have with the church in my community, and I believe in your community too, and I say Euro-Americans is you. I can speak for Black Americans. I have some sense of our history as to how we perceive the church as an institution that's in a position to provide service to the community. Historically, in the Black community, we have had a very strong sense of having church, you know, as something that fills our lives with music, with love, you know, fellowship, and those kinds of things. You know, in other words, in the Black community, those people who go to church like to have church. Okay. And I don't think anything can change that, but I also think that's true for you. You like to have church. And I distinguish having church from having responsibility for a ministry. Okay? We do a pretty good job at having church. And we go to great limits, I think, to have church even when it excludes having ministry.
Church is a social occasion. Is that...
Yes. Yes. Very social, and I think very useful. But the problem we have is that we shut ourselves off a lot of times from ministry in order to make sure that we have church. Now, let me just tell you how I can say that. I became a Lutheran 25 years ago, and I got married in a lovely Lutheran church, which is where my wife was going. I was following her. I'm a Baptist in background, but I followed her to the Lutheran church. And haven't regretted it. Okay, I don't want to say that to convey the wrong thought. But anyway, this is a big, lovely church. And back in 1965, you know, the church was about 50-50 Black and white. Maybe 60-40 in favor of European Americans. As the years waned, the European Americans moved out. And the Black folks were left with the church, this big church that was meant for 1,200. And our membership, you know, dwindled to about 300, much too big. I thought that, you know, as the European Americans left, they were actually turning their backs on an opportunity for ministry. Okay? I think that what they were doing was chasing an opportunity to continue to have church. Great, you know, they wanted to have church in their community, right? And they went to suburbia, to various churches. And you know what? The Black folks who were left almost did the same thing. That's how much we are into to having church. We did the same thing, but we finally decided that we inherited an opportunity to have our own church. So that didn't mean the difference that much in terms of our thinking, because we're still thinking church. It's just that we were determined not to let the white folks shut off the opportunity for us to have church. So we said, we're not going to run. We're going to have church right here. And so we've done that. reasonably well. We've done it in the sense that we have taken three different churches, the church of which I was formerly a member, joined with two other congregations. We developed a tribe, and we did that for survival, because if we hadn't, chances are we would have lost the chance or the opportunity to have church. And so we took three and made one church and built this nice, lovely building on a plot of land that is located right in the heart of the city, the lower east side of the city of Detroit. And we have an excellent time there. We love each other very much. We go to church every Sunday. We sing songs of praise. And we talk of our love for Christ. But our shortcoming is that we have not gotten to the point of actually developing a ministry that is relevant to that community. And I think that's historically what many of us have done, even the Baptists, you know. And Lutherans certainly are no different, you know. But where we are right now, and this has taken us by the year about eight years in the making. In 1982, we merged, and we're given a lot of credit, you know, for the efforts, and we were commended because it was difficult. Anybody who was close to that knows that it was very difficult. Notwithstanding, we wanted to have church together. We still had the problem of trust. Notwithstanding that these were all black folks, they were not all of one fabric, you know, which is an assumption that we frequently make about people of color. We have different attitudes about worship. Some people like to have a very conservative approach to worship. And others want a more relaxed gospel approach to, and we had tremendous difficulty trying to overcome that. And we're still having some problems. So where are we right now in this approach to ministry? In the last year, we have begun talks about gearing up to do ministry. And I'm saying that because it takes that kind of time. We just don't do it overnight. We have put together a committee that we call a church assessment committee. It's like an outreach committee. And we've listed a variety of activities in which we have had to engage over the year. One thing that we had to do was a kind of survey of the pastor to find out where he is. We've had to do a survey of the church members to find out what their sentiments are, what their attitudes are with respect to developing a ministry of outreach. And we've had to set up boundaries of the community to identify what we call our parish, which really immediately set off some real negative sentiments, because the minute we set up boundaries, there were people who said that since we don't live within the boundaries, it sounds as though you are excluding us. And that's almost like cutting us out of your church. So politically, that has created some real problems. And we're not sure how we're going to get through that. We had some heated discussions about that just 2 or 3 weeks ago. We have also done some real brainstorming about what the needs of the community are and how we will approach, you know, those providing services for those needs. Let me just tell you where we're located in terms of needs. I said a second ago is in the inner city of Detroit. We happen to be in the area which feeds the criminal justice system. We happen to have a large percentage of unwed mothers, large percentage of child abuse, large percentage of the chemical dependency in the city. Much of the drug activity is within that community. So what I'm saying is if we want to talk about ministry, I think it's the potential avenues are well defined for us already. But we have not permitted ourselves to fall prey to the temptation to say that we know what the community needs and we are going to address those needs in that posture. That's another political issue. But what I'm saying is, I think we have to know what the needs are. At least we have to have a sense of what those needs are, and then begin gearing up to talk about ministry. So we set up the committee, and we identified resource persons in the community. And what our plans are right now are to have meetings with those people and to meet with block clubs throughout the community and engage in a partnership arrangement with them, as opposed to taking it for granted that we can set up, you know, a lot of the good things. I happen to know that church people at Genesis, my church, feel very strongly about illiteracy, and rightfully so, because in the city of Detroit we're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of a illiteracy rate of 35 to 40%, and that's the general population, and the rates are even higher for a number of persons within a certain age, such as 14 to I think it's like 21. But we have, you know, set ourselves up so that we know that we have a lot of internal teaching to do. We have a cell job to do. The pastor knows that. The committee that has been set up really understands that. And so it's not going to be an overnight task. We expect some members are going to have a tough time, because this is leading them into new waters. And that should not be, you know, but that's not the reality. You have to deal with what is, as opposed to what we would like to think. It's difficult sometimes to think that we as church people don't seem to recognize that the community and the problems of the community actually represent the essence of the challenge of our Christianity, not just Christianity in the generic, because sometimes when you say it's the essence of Christianity, you sort of take yourself out of it. It represents the essence of our individual and collective ministry. And if you run away from that, then you're running away from what I think the charge of a Christian happens to be. We don't know where we're going to end up with this, but we feel confident that we're on the right track. I feel that this is where I need to be. Professionally, I have a full life. There's no question about that. Psychologists are doing pretty well because the need is out there and they're paid well. But I also feel that what mental health people have to do, particularly those who are in the church, is lend their services in a particular sense, in involving themselves in the work of the church in leadership capacity, in giving services. I happen to give a lot of my service, not just to church, but also to community organizations within the city. I sit on a variety of boards, one with Ingrid, of course, but that's the National Church Board, but a lot of Wayne County, Detroit. And I say that as what I think the example, and my example are some other people who I look to for leadership in that regard. I don't see any other way out of it. I happen to believe that in the black community, particularly, the church has to find its way into leadership of bringing people out of this mess that we're in. We have to, as a church, as a whole, learn to not just concern ourselves with the people who are incarcerated, Certainly, as I said earlier, we can't become insensitive, you know, to those people. We have to be concerned about them. We have to be concerned about disparities in sentencing. We have to be concerned about the death penalty and who that targets and why, you know. But beyond that, we really have to look at conditions that feed the criminal justice system. If we lose focus of that, you know, then we forget that while we're down the stream pulling people out, as the old example goes, there are people up the stream constantly throwing them in. And so we need people upstream working to prevent those conditions. There are no easy solutions. And so let's just talk about those kinds of problems. Let's hear, if you will, where you see yourselves, not just the national church. It's easy to say where the church should be, but let's talk about where you see your church, perhaps, if not yourself individually. Could we do that? Well, or any questions that you want to ask me about what we've been doing so far?
As you were speaking, I was thinking about the church I belong to. I've belonged to this church for a couple of years. It's the church I joined when I made an exit of the Catholic Church, and it's a Baptist church. And, of course, Baptist is new to me, but I'm told that some of the things that go on are sort of universal.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a big church of a couple of thousand people. Bigger than I would like for it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel as though it's located in an area in Richmond, you know, California, a big, prominent, actually, black church. I haven't felt yet that the church is doing all it can for the community.
Mm-hmm.
What I see happening is groups, circles, you know, people, committee and that committee and the women's group here, and you know how it's divided for people to work.
Mm-hmm.
And doing things on a small scale basis, Thanksgiving comes and somebody wants to do a food drive. But I don't see constant outreach. When I think of that, I think of a church whose doors should always have a long line of folk who need stuff lined up to mm-hmm. come in. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's when I see outreach, that's what I see, the doors open at all times.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who needs to come there, of course, there should be a program identified with the church. This is St. John's outreach to the poor, to the incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
It should be identified by the community.
Mm-hmm.
People should know that they can send people there. It should be on the list of resources. I think every church ought to have as its goal to get on the list of places to send folk who need
mm-hmm.
help.
Mm-hmm.
And I bring it up from time to time, a couple of groups that I'm in, and people will say, but you remember when the choir did this? And do you remember when? And I think at some point, I don't know how to move people beyond that. I don't know what to do after that, except to keep saying it.
Right. We have that problem. One of the problems we have is the fear that the have-nots are going to come and take over the church. Okay? That they're going to be there, their physical presence is going to be a threat. It's as though we don't want them there bringing the host of their activities. We don't want them there playing cards. We don't want them there holding meetings. We don't want to turn it into a community center. I mean, ownership of the church is standing in the way of outreach. That's a real fear, and I'm speaking. Now, I think that is buying into the church's way of exercising racism, because it's excluding, it's offering support to oppressive activity, it's giving comfort. People of the community are in tremendous need. The social institution, Department of Social Services, are not able to meet the needs of the community in totality. No way. Just can't. And so we need to look at larger, you know, a larger number of institutions of the community. Yes, Ingrid.
But really, doesn't it seem like if the church is just going to provide service to the homeless, service to the food for the hungry, but it's the same exact metaphor that you just gave us. It's fishing people out of the stream downstream and giving them a little food and then basically throwing them back in the stream.
Yeah.
It's not going upstream and saying, why are they hungry? Why are they homeless? Why did young men turn to crime? You know, it's the same, doing the same thing all over. It's not making any difference.
Well, I think that what you're saying is that the church needs to be involved on a broader plane.
Mm-hmm.
If we're looking at, you know, I'm speaking of a parish organization, okay, in your particular community,
the
small thing.
Parish energy, feeding the hungry. You know, maybe it should be in some kind of jobs development so that there aren't hungry.
Well, you see, that's, you're absolutely right, and that's exactly what, see, one of the things, as I talk a little bit about the model that we have, is that we don't presume to know what the answers are. What we have decided is that a partnership with the community makes more sense than anything else, you see. And there's a politics of church involving itself in community activity. We have to be very careful, and I say we have to be careful in both ways. One way you have to be careful is to make sure that you don't let the community be the reason why you don't do anything. Because some people will say, we're not going to do that because the community is not interested, and so we're just going to be cool and let them come to us. On the other hand, you have to make sure that you don't act as if you have all the answers, and you go out and set up a bunch of, you know, programs, and then you expect the community to come to you. But I wouldn't say that that's the best, you know. I'm not even saying that the community has the best sense of what needs to be done. I think that if you ask me personally, it makes more sense for the church to be in a way, be involved in a way to somehow impact economic decisions, you know, impact, you know, significant political decisions. And I think, you know, the parish is not involved at that level, unless I'm being very naive. You know, I think we'd be naive to believe that the parish is, you know, we're playing small politics, but nevertheless, I think some meaningful politics. When we talk about the church, I think you have to conceptualize, quote unquote, the church. I mean, there's the parish, and there's the national church, and there's a collection of churches, ELCAs, and Missouri Synods, and others, if they can get beyond their, and I don't want to offend anybody, but their petty differences, to get to the larger issues of human life. So I think, Ingrid, I believe that that's where, you know, the bigger issues of pulling them out would be addressed. You know, and certainly you'd get into those kinds of things. Educational, you know, issues. I mean, who actually makes a decision to say the city of Detroit must have a ratio of teacher to pupil of 15 to 1, or 1 to 15 teacher to pupil, 1 to 15, as opposed to 1 to 35? How do you deal with that solution? You know, obviously, you're talking about political solutions, but you're also talking about very economic issues as well. I think the church can be involved at that level. You know, but it has to make that its priority. The church, I think, is... I think there are lots of powerful church people, you know, in positions to do something, but it's not very sociable, or it's not very social, or it's asocial, or it's not political to address some of those issues. And I think that if we don't do anything collectively, and the churches collectively, I think, can bring power by making statements. You know, but you know, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. You know,
I think one of the things we do in the church is to wait for money and permission and approval by state and federal or whatever powers to be in the city. I think anything that the state or the city or whoever can do, the church can do itself. I can see, for instance, in our church, I can easily see a tutoring program going on. Mm-hmm. There are enough teachers in a church that size, mm-hmm. To do this. I can also see the church having its own, when I say, I'm talking about this particular church now, or any church could see it as a model, own type of AA program.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be large scale, doesn't even have to be fed into that.
Right.
Could have its own drug rehabilitation.
Right.
With people with that expertise. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think we draw enough right. on the resources right in a given right. parish, for
Precisely.
Instance. On a small scale, and that's the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We tend to wait until the big money comes,
right.
or until that big right. moment comes when somebody says, now let's give this church a hand.
Right.
We have to do that.
And even if I think getting down to the actual doing of it, I think is what you were saying earlier, people are just scared.
Mm-hmm.
I think of my home congregation I just left, we have there's a help house kind of a food concept that we're doing food throughout, maybe once a month, we make food drives and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then one Sunday we had someone come into church, just kind of wandering, it was like a street person. And he looked at this guy, mm-hmm. he's dirty, he smelled, mm-hmm. All of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There was a perfect opportunity to reach out and help this man, but nobody
mm-hmm.
did anything.
Mm-hmm.
But we're helping the help house, we're helping this, we're helping that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were scared.
Mm-hmm.
And it really gets down to the mm-hmm. having the people come in, as you say, having it here mm-hmm. in your congregation, having mm-hmm. the meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Face to face, here it is.
Mm-hmm.
We're scared to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's filters up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Breaking barriers is tough. My guess is that's why people behind Rainbow on the Mountaintop see the need for this kind of interfacing, to simply educate ourselves. This is a good start, you know.
One brief story that gave me a lot of hope a couple of years ago was that I was involved with an evaluation for the Justice Department of not, unfortunately, anything that has really taken off. But the idea was that there are so many people out there who are absolutely scared to death by the costs that you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
right? That more and more judges in other parts of the criminal justice system are looking for alternatives to incarceration,
mm-hmm.
right? Around the country, in response to that, a lot of very grassroots, community-based efforts have begun to provide, particularly young people, with alternatives to incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a project that we got going
mm-hmm.
to try to collect the best of those from really mm-hmm. poor communities, what
mm-hmm.
grassroots folks were doing
mm-hmm.
to provide young people with some kind of way not to get into the prison track,
mm-hmm.
right? Get
mm-hmm.
wound in there. And we went around, and we wrote an evaluation, some of the stuff we looked at, and we just saw incredible stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The poorest neighborhood in Baltimore has a thing called the Baltimore Family Life Center, which is adopting young kids,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Mm-hmm.
Adopting kids in extended African-American families,
mm-hmm.
and setting up African-modeled sets of discipline,
mm-hmm.
right,
mm-hmm.
on the kids. Reintegrating them into the community
mm-hmm.
in ways that they were never integrated before.
Mm-hmm.
Some folks in East Harlem, and there was a church involved in this one too,
mm-hmm.
have an entire youth-based construction company.
Mm-hmm.
And the court assigns the kids to this mm-hmm. church, and the church has gotten the money together to provide the training, and they all become carpenters. And now
mm-hmm.
they become actually accountants too. I mean, they do the business end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Of the housing business too.
Mm-hmm.
Some folks in Camden, New Jersey, which is a really poor town,
mm-hmm.
have started now 5 youth enterprises. They got a pizza restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
They got the corner on the New Jersey poinsettia business.
Mm-hmm. Right?
They started a greenhouse, and they decided mm-hmm. what's a way to make some money off of, you know, that really insures income. So they got all the corporations in New Jersey who have to buy poinsettias when Christmas comes around
right.
to contract with these young people. the court had assigned them.
Okay.
To, for all their poinsettias, right? So this is the sort of basis of their business uh-huh. at this point.
Uh-huh.
And all this stuff is really coming up from the grassroots.
Uh-huh.
And it's not getting enough money to sort of really grow.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an awful lot of opportunity there, it seems to me, for local parishes.
Mm-hmm.
I'll bet local parishes could begin to get some money from mm-hmm. a criminal justice system which recognizes
yes.
that it takes $20,000 a year to keep a guy in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And say, give us half of that.
Mm-hmm.
And for half of that, you know,
mm-hmm.
we can put together something that makes sense for these young people
mm-hmm.
and not have to put them into that kind of thing. Seems
right.
to me we're getting desperate enough for some kinds of solutions yeah. like this to begin to bubble up.
Absolutely. Society. Absolutely. And I think, that did I see a hand over here? Absolutely. We have begun to think in terms of not just what we can do with the money we have in the church, but how we can set up a nonprofit and organization, perhaps, to write proposals, you know, for to get funded for certain kinds of things. You know, I have, you know, given my professional, I have certain biases. One of my biases is that the family needs to immediately be addressed. There's no question about it. There are too many, you know, parents who are not able, by virtue of not understanding and feeling overwhelmed. Too many, you know, teenage mothers out there who need help, and just on the strength of the fact that they're overwhelmed themselves. Suggest very, I mean, that they need assistance in dealing with just the daily struggles of living. They don't have time sometimes to, and don't know the right thing to do with their kids when they're confronted with conflicts. Many of them are burdened with their own personal lives, with their own anger, getting caught up with being a parent. And so they act out much of that anger and hostility on kids. Yes.
I'm sure that this is going different in different areas of the country, but here, right in Salem, Oregon, we have a grant going right now, and it is teaching young mothers and how to care for their children, and learn, teaching them how to give them love, because that's, I mean, as you know, the people that are in the jails or prisons
mm-hmm.
are the ones who have never had much love. They've
mm-hmm.
had much pain and suffering with abuse.
Well, they've had what the mothers thought was love, but really was not, you know, because some mothers overindulge thinking that that's love.
Isn't part of the problem that we're having here is we can recognize that this person or this group of people have a need, but they don't recognize that they have that need.
You mean the ones who are incarcerated?
Right.
Okay.
It's, and even, you know, we've got people, if we're using the river analogy, we can stand downstream and pull these people out and say, gee, you know, it's really too bad you're an addict. You know, gee, it's really too bad you're an addict. And the guy up there is jumping in the river, not realizing that he's an addict, and not understanding. And you can stand up at the, up there and say, you know, we don't want you to jump in. The guy said, well, why not?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of tough, but it sounds like what we need is kind of an intervention program
mm-hmm.
with in some different areas, which is tough because interventions are tough. People don't want to hear that they have
mm-hmm.
a problem. They don't want to hear that they can't raise their kids. You know, that they're not raising kids.
Well, you're absolutely right. Sometimes, because of the depth of our problems, we lose vision and lose focus of what our needs actually are. But at the same time, there are large numbers of folks who do want help. And so if we were to work with those who need it, I think we'd find ourselves very, very busy. Indeed, there are lots of those out there who just don't know which way to go. And even when you expose them to what we call opportunity, they don't bite. That happens.
They don't recognize that that's a solution to their problem.
Right. I don't know how large the numbers are for that, though. I think that there are large numbers out there of those who want and would receive if we would give it. However, we also have to understand that in the giving process, you're not going to get rewards overnight. In other words, they're not going to show you evidence of their having invested into what you think is right for them. It's a process of learning. Just as it's a process of learning for church people to believe that they can make a difference. Because a lot of us don't believe that we can make a difference, you know, in terms of reaching out. Church people have to do a teaching process with each other. I mean, they have to actually try to bring others along. And that's a time-consuming effort.